Happy Thursday to you. Welcome to Main Street. I'm Eric Detheridge. Kind of a cooler day across much of North Dakota. Hope you are enjoying it. The air seems fairly clear. That's a good thing. In the second half of the show, Tom Brousseau takes you to Medora, where he's actually performing all this summer, and talks with a couple of members of the cast of the North Dakota Shakespeare Festival's recent performance there of As You Like It. Yes, as you can hear, I'm having some fun in anticipation of Matt Olien's review of the new Superman movie. Man, there are lots of songs about the Man of Steel, are there not? But first, what goes into good interior design? Greg Blumenschein talks with Susan Ray Deggs, a rock star educator in the interior design world, who says it's less about aesthetic and more about making more inclusive and accessible spaces for people.
We're with Professor Susan Ray Deggs. From Fargo to Las Vegas, big things are happening for one of North Dakota's most respected educators. Professor Susan Ray Deggs of North Dakota State University has just been named the 2025 Top Professor of the Year in Interior Design by the International Association of Top Professionals. Congratulations.
Thank you. It has really blown my socks off. When they contacted me, I was totally taken aback.
You've spent over 30 years shaping the future of interior design, not only as a nationally recognized scholar and licensed designer, but as a mentor and a leader at North Dakota State University. It's my understanding that you focus on inclusive design, aging in place, and real world experience. And we're having this interview in a coffee shop. And I want to lead this off by asking, everywhere you step into, do you look around and say, oh, if they would have only?
That is a constant thread of my life, and my students as well as my family know that I'm going to be constantly looking and picking and noticing things. My family doesn't sometimes like to travel with me.
Let's start with the national recognition. How did you find out that you were named the top interior design professor of the year, and what went through your mind?
They basically emailed me out of the blue, and I laid my head down on my laptop and didn't know what to say. I was like, what is this? And I reached out to them. I said, how did you find me? And they said, well, initially we found you through LinkedIn, and then we basically dug around on you and found different resources. And that's how they came to find
me. The interior design sleuth.
Yeah,
got after it.
They had a committee that reviewed me, and someone had nominated me, and it just blew me away. Like I said, I'm a very humble person who doesn't like people to, like, you know, do all this kind of thing, and eventually go to Las Vegas, as you noted, for a red carpet kind of event. This is enough to really almost bring tears to my eyes. Yeah.
I mentioned earlier that you have more than three decades of contributing to design education. What first sparked your interest in interior design and then teaching it?
I actually did work in Southern Missouri at a firm, as well as something that would be similar to you all would recognize, like as Home Depot or Lowe's. It was a very small, locally owned place. And that's how I actually got started. But if you take it all the way back, it was in what would have been a family and consumer science class, and even all the way further back would have been 4-H.
So we're talking high school and pre-high school days.
Yes. And I had a lovely time doing 4-H projects that were related to creating interior elements. And then when we had what you all would call family consumer science projects, we had a teacher that had us do interior design things. And I just kept building on that. And then when you have a sibling that is also in interior design that's a little bit older, you just ride on that and you're like, I think I want to do this. I think. And then when the education piece came into it, as far as being a teacher, I started being an adjunct, and I really got engaged with the students. So I thought, okay, I think I'll try this master's and see if I want to do this or not. And yes, it really led me down a pathway where I really enjoyed working with the students and mentoring with them.
What would surprise me most about your educational journey in interior design?
Surprise you most? Probably when I originally went for my master's, I was maybe thinking about doing my focus area. I kept on going back and forth whether I was going to do historic preservation or aging in place and inclusivity. And to this day now, I'm so glad I went more towards the aging in place inclusivity because it gave me a much broader range. The funny thing is I teach actually history, but the aging in place inclusivity has really broadened my perspective since the 80s, and knowing that we still can't get our acts together in our interiors and in our commercial spaces to support people. And when we look at neurodiversity and all the other pieces and parts in people's mental health, and we've got to do a much better job than we are currently doing.
Even with the American with Disabilities Act, you're saying we still fall short?
Oh, we fall way short. And I get so angry about when I go in commercial spaces that should be meeting ADA and they're brand new and they are not where they need to be.
What's our responsibility when we notice something like that?
If you notice something like that, it actually should be turned into, or at least initially approaching the building and say, hey, could there be some modifications you can make to accommodate people? You can actually, if a new building has been built, you can go after the actual organization and there can actually be a suit fined against those people, though I don't want to like cause a bunch of ripples and make everybody angry at me. But there have been those lawsuits and things that have been done.
That surprises me in this age of new construction with the experience that we've had.
All the code officials and everything are supposed to review them. Every once in a while, things slip under the belt.
Sure. You've described the award that you won, Dr. Ray Diggs, as something that reflects the support of many. Tell me who some of the people or even the communities were that shaped you along the way.
One group that has, there's actually two. There's the American Society of Interior Design. They're a professional group that I've been in since the 80s. I'm also a fellow for that group. I was an officer down in the Minnesota area, but I also help work with the student chapter here in Fargo with our student group. And again, it's a professional group that's always providing education as well as mentorship opportunities for students and basically networking so students can make connections. They actually are having their 50th anniversary this year down in Atlanta. And then another group that's very important to me is the Interior Design Educators Council. And I'm a fellow in that group, but I've also been a president of their group. But that is a group because of their focus on helping the educators of each generation lead the next group of students and help them learn so they can be out in the profession, but also helping work with the next group of educators. How can we best prepare our students so they can be successful designers? And this is a group where we have our meetings, where we're giving presentations to help each other, research. We also have a research journal, and it's 60 years old.
Are you in the, is it the School of Architecture?
We are now in SOTA School of Architecture, SOTA. And then I'm in the Department of Architecture and Interior Design.
In preparing for this interview, I wondered, are there conflicts that arise when new ideas are discussed from an exterior perspective versus where you focus on the interior design of buildings?
There is more collaboration and teamwork than there has been previously. I'm not going to say conflicts do not arise, but with us now actually being in the Department of Architecture and Interior Design, we hopefully to see more collaboration across our areas. We had a transformation at our university. We'll start year three this fall, and we'll have a chance to hopefully develop more collaboration across our programs.
When a student comes to you and says, I want to be an interior designer, from your perspective, generally, why are they saying that? Why is there interest?
Oh, that's always an interesting point that you make there, because when I visit the prospective student, I actually ask them, what is it that sparks your interest in this? And I'll ask them what they've done since they've been little. And some of them, it's been like, I've rearranged my room, or I've painted, or I've done this, or I've watched this kind of thing on TV. So I'm trying to figure out what it is that sparks their interest. And usually after the first year, there may be some that go, this wasn't quite what I thought it was, because it is a combination of science and art. So
it's like oil and water, isn't it?
Well, I guess you could say that, yeah.
My wife, I think, is a great interior designer, and I'm not, so I have to defer to her. Is it generally that way? Is it a female-dominated profession, generally?
Actually, no, it's equal across.
Really?
It just depends on which programs you're at, sometimes in which school and which regions you're in. Some areas are more heavily balanced out with male and female. Because I know we have a flow. We'll have like a year where we have a more equal balance, but again, some years it's more heavily balanced. We'll have couple of young men and the rest are females, and they always joke about, yeah, it's like having a large group of sisters with me. But yeah, it just depends on what year it is.
My guest here on Main Street is Professor Susan Ray Deggs of North Dakota State University, and she's just been named the 2025 Top Professor of the Year in Interior Design by the International Association of Top Professionals. One of the highlights of the program that you are a part of is the Shields Design Challenge. Tell me what that is, what's the event like, and how does it prepare students for real design careers?
This has been a beautiful ongoing experience we've had with Shields, and we appreciate their support. The students, actually this spring, they were broken down into their teams. There's a limited number of students that get to participate each year because you only have so many design vignettes. They'll have a theme they get to pick, and Shields lets them have a budget to pick out so many accessories or items that will go with their theme. And then come the assigned Sunday that we've selected in the fall, they will have 3.5 hours, we start early, to pick out and get everything arranged in their vignette. And there will have been paint and wall covering put up as their backdrop. They do not do their wall covering on that Sunday. They've done that prior. They get to all hang out wall covering. But this is a really great learning experience, because if you're working with clients, and sometimes there is a great timeline, but this is great for them to actually work with a budget, work with unique materials to create a certain design concept. And once they have worked and run around the store picking up the rest of the things to go with their design solution, they will have local design professionals that will come in and judge their solution and give them feedback. And last year was real interesting. The judges actually came up to me and they were like, Susan, and I'm like, what? What's wrong? This is going to be a rough year because these are all just pretty equal. And it's come and go as far as, you know, how successful teams have been able to pull off their themes. And it has been an awesome learning experience. In fact, I took it to my IDEC conference this, it was accepted, and I took it to my IDEC conference in Chicago this past spring, our annual meeting. And now I've got a bunch of other colleagues across the United States that want to find one of their local people that will actually maybe sponsor a similar event, because having the students have this challenge of time, but also collaborating with each other, when you have a limited amount of time and you got to run around the store and pull these things together and create a theme, and then the judges vote on it, but then it's up for a week for the public to vote on it. And it goes out on social media. And this year we had the highest number of votes that we've ever had. And we really like pushing it out for people to give the students their votes. And like, which one did you like the best? What's the people's choice and what's the judge's choice? And it really supports the students in their learning experience.
I've seen tools online where I can take a picture of a space and have AI do the work for me. What's your thoughts about AI in the world of interior design?
There's a lot of discussion about AI right now. There is, the funny thing is sort of what I call AI or systems like that have been used for rendering and that, but you have to be careful what AI systems you're using, that it's not overstepping its bounds into copyrighted material and that it's only perhaps being used for renderings and that. We're actually having conversations like that in our professional groups, and in some firms, they're writing limitations about what it can or cannot be applied for. And so when I get all of my interns back this summer, I'm going to ask them how it was applied in each of their firms. And we even talk about how much AI can be used in written discussions for their papers on campus. And there has to be limitations so that the students are still using their noodles in their heads. And also, if you're not stealing something from some other firm, that should actually be private information that is copyrighted.
Right.
And that's the piece that gets real iffy. If this is copyrighted and it's private information and somehow got in the system, then you're stealing somebody else's information.
Are you worried that AI will limit opportunities for some of your students looking forward?
We will have to see how this all pans out. I mean, as far as like the rendering ability and some of those kind of things, I'm not as concerned, though I did see some interesting presentations on AI at our conference where AI generated some furniture designs and stuff, and they were wonky. It left off some legs on tables and things.
Because they float.
Yeah, I'm like, I'm sorry, we don't have floating furniture yet.
You've been a mentor to many. You talked about that earlier, and people have been a mentor to you.
Yes.
When people in your program graduate, what's your last bit of advice that you tell them as they're entering this world of interior design?
I always tell students that while you may have your first job, reminding them that you may just stay there for a short period, because people used to stay at positions for a long time, but I said, this is just getting your feet wet. You've already had your internship, and some of them actually stay with their internships and continue to work at it, but you're getting your feet wet to see if this is going to be a fit for you. And students move around a lot. Other people stay with their positions for a while, but always being having their chance to network and always never burn any bridges, because you want to make those connections and have a positive relation with people out in the industry. And the one thing that other people in other disciplines find really odd about us is we are almost connected forever, because our world is pretty small. Even though there's a lot of us, we're all intertwined in our areas. And like, the students know who a person is that's a rep for selling a certain kind of material or fabric or carpet. And so they network with those people and develop those relationships, and they may know there's a job in someplace else, and they can reach out to that person and ask them. So I always tell them to develop those relationships.
I'm sure you've seen new materials, new technologies every month or every week. Come your way.
Yeah.
What's the coolest innovation in interior design that really excites you?
That is almost impossible to answer, because it is constantly rolling out. I'm constantly looking at new fabrics and textiles that come out, and new colors. I am constantly rolling something out every week, so I can't even answer that truthfully, because I'm not going to get a vendor mad at me.
I respect that. Do you enjoy research, or do you enjoy teaching when it comes to interior design?
It's a little bit of both, because actually what I've done in the past, for example, I used the example of the Shields student project, and I shared it as an example with my colleagues at a conference. I actually compiled a whole bunch of their responses and used it as a mini research project. Yet I have another research study that I'm doing with aging in place, and I want to support older adults in their homes. So it's sort of a 50-50. I mean, I love teaching and I love to do that, but I also love to dive into research. So it's sort of a 50-50 balance.
What's the biggest mistake that folks make if they want to buy their last home that they're going to live in for a long time when they retire?
They often don't consider if they're going to have something on one level, if a disability occurs where they need to have mobility devices, and they don't realize that, oh, you might have to add grab bars, and so you're gonna have to rip into your walls in your bathroom to add additional supports that actually you can fasten your grab bars into. So, I mean, there's that whole piece and part there, but if you have it on one level, and can have a bedroom and a bathroom on that level, and accessibility on that level, as we call one level entries and things like that, then you might be okay.
Are there countries that get it better than the United States when it comes to designing for aging in place?
There's a few places in our Nordic countries that have done a little bit better, because we modeled some of that after them, but in actuality, no. We're all sort of fighting with those kinds of things.
And finally, as we kind of wrap up our conversation, there's a student, or maybe the parent of a student, who's in middle school or high school that thinks maybe this might be for them. What would you tell them to do to prepare?
What I have done with middle school and even high school students, if they're sitting a little bit on the fence, I actually have them go do a shadowing experience with local designers, whether they're here in the FM community or even if they're down in the cities or all over the place, people will reach out to me. I said, let's go see who we can have you shadow for a day and see if this looks like something that you would be interested in doing.
Our thanks to Professor Susan Ray Deggs. She continues to shape the next generation of interior designers right here in North Dakota, and is being celebrated now on a national stage. Again, congratulations.
Thank you. It has been an awe-inspiring opportunity, and to this day, I'm still just shaking my head. I'm like, how did these people find me?
I hope you enjoyed Craig Blumenschein's conversation with Susan Ray Deggs, an award-winning NDSU interior design professor. Coming up, climate change is impacting indigenous health in rural Nevada. In this latest installment of Our Living Land, you'll learn about some solutions. Support for Prairie Public is provided by Jade Presents, bringing Sierra Farrell's Shoot for the Moon Tour to the Up District Festival Field in Fargo, Monday, July 28th. Gates open at 5 p.m. Concert begins at 6:30, rain or shine. More information at jadepresents.com. Capital Shakespeare of Bismarck presents A Midsummer Night's Dream, a whimsical tale of love, mischief, and magic under the midsummer moon. Enjoy the production in the round, on the lawn, at their new location outside Sidney J. Lee Auditorium on the Bismarck State College campus. Performances start at 7 p.m. July 16th and run through July 20th, and are open to the public with free will donations accepted. Limited concessions available, lawn chairs or blankets are encouraged. More information at capitalshakespeare.org.
This is Our Living Lands, and I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Extreme heat and stronger storms pose health risks for Indigenous communities. Our Living Lands producer Daniel Spalding spoke to the Mountain West News Bureau's Kayla Bradle about the ways climate change is impacting Indigenous health in Nevada and what tribes are doing about it.
Can you describe the mobile health clinic and who it is serving?
Yeah, the Fallon Paiute Shoshone Tribe in northern Nevada has a mobile health clinic that was funded last year by a grant from the U.S. Department of Agriculture. Specifically, the grant was for expanding rural healthcare access after the pandemic, so the tribe used it to start a mobile clinic. And the clinic is pretty big. It's about the size of a large motorhome. It's got two patient rooms with exam tables, a bathroom, a lab with a blood draw station, so they can do everything from immunizations to lab testing to wound care, and it's all being operated by trained doctors and nurses. And this clinic provides care for its members and members of the Lovelock Paiute and Yamba Shoshone tribes, which adds up to about 2,000 and patients that they're serving.
Why is this clinic so important, and what healthcare gaps is it filling?
These tribes are in very remote areas. Members of the Yamba Shoshone tribe have to drive a 4-hour round trip to the Fallon Tribal Health Center to get care. That's the closest Indian Health Service facility. And then the Lovelock Paiute members have to drive a 2-hour round trip. That's a lot of time and gas money that people can't afford. So many just aren't getting the preventative or even urgent care that they need. So the mobile clinic, it covers a 200-mile territory serving these tribes. It tries to visit each tribe once a month and averages about 20 patients a month. And obviously, accessing quality health care has always been an issue for tribal nations. The Indian Health Service has less than 100 hospitals and medical clinics nationwide. That's all to serve about 2.8 million Native Americans and Alaska Natives.
Can you talk about the ways that climate change impacts the health of Indigenous communities in Nevada?
Yeah, one of the main impacts are rising temperatures and extreme heat, which is caused by climate change. Many tribal homes don't have air conditioning or even electricity. So keeping cool and avoiding heat stroke and heat exhaustion can be a challenge. A stat I'll throw at you, between 2004 and 2018, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention found that Indigenous groups had the highest rates of heat-related deaths. And nationwide, heat is the leading cause of weather-related deaths for all groups. And here in northern Nevada, we have some of the fastest warming cities in the country. Reno, where I'm based, actually ranks number one. Over the past 5 decades, the city's average annual temperature has jumped by nearly 8 degrees. And these climate trends concern doctors. I spoke with Dr. Christopher Chai while the mobile clinic was at a health fair.
We live in a desert, so every summer it's always an issue of concern. Are patients hydrating well enough? And then interestingly, in the wintertime, are they also hydrating well enough too? And so when you have temperature extremes on either end, because climate change can occur either way, it can dehydrate the patients.
And he says they're on high alert for heat-related illnesses this time of year.
In the story, you also talk about transportation. How does climate change make traveling to health facilities harder?
Well, as Dr. Chai just said in that clip, climate change can occur in the wintertime too. While yes, winters in the West are trending warmer, research shows that climate change can lead to more severe winter storms and cold snaps. As I mentioned, these Nevada tribes being served by the mobile clinic are very remote. The Yamba Shoshone tribe's reservation is very small and tucked in a mountain range, basically in the middle of nowhere. John Pashon is the director of the Fallon Tribal Health Center and Mobile Clinic. He says there's only one road leading in and out of the reservation, and most of the drive is on a narrow dirt road.
During winter, it's really bad because a lot of the passes get closed down, so sometimes we actually can't make it out there, but we try our best to make it up the next time or the next week.
Despite the challenges, this is a story about tribes working together to solve a problem. Why did you want to highlight that aspect of the story?
Well, I think it's important to shine a light on solutions being developed to address inequities facing tribal communities. This mobile health clinic is not a cure-all, pardon the pun, but it's bridging a pretty wide healthcare gap in this part of the West. I interviewed a few tribal members who hadn't been to the doctor in years and were now up to date on immunizations, got lab work done for the first time in like a decade, and were scheduled for cancer screenings and imaging. And that's all because of this mobile clinic giving them that access to consistent care.
Tune in next week for more stories about how climate change affects tribal communities. I'm Antonia Gonzalez for Our Living Lands, a collaboration of Kiwanis Broadcast Corporation, Native Public Media, and the Mountain West News Bureau.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
You are listening to Main Street on listener-supported Prairie Public. I'm Eric Dethridge for Craig Blumenschein, who will be back with you on Monday. Hope you are enjoying the program. If you're just joining us, coming up in just a little bit, Matt Olien is going to review the latest installment of Superman. Don't miss that. Tom Brousseau will take us to Medora for a little performance of North Dakota Shakespeare Festival's take on the Bards As You Like It. But first, let's get you caught up on some regional news.
From the Prairie Public Newsroom, I'm Katie David. The North Dakota Ethics Commission is looking into whether strongly worded communications from the State Attorney General's office have negatively impacted commission staff. That from the North Dakota Monitor. The decision follows a July 3rd letter addressed to the commission from Attorney General Drew Wrigley that harshly criticizes the commission's recent investigation report on ethics violation by Bismarck Representative Jason Doctor. The report said the Attorney General's office at times did not cooperate with the investigation and did not turn over some requested records, a characterization Wrigley called patently false. Wrigley said his office gave the commission access to all requested records except when pending investigations and court proceedings prevented them from being turned over. His letter went on to accuse Ethics Commission Executive Director Rebecca Binstock and her staff of inexperience and poor judgment. Tonight, mostly cloudy, showers likely with a chance of thunderstorms through the night, lows in the upper 40s to upper 50s. Friday, mostly sunny, southwest to mostly cloudy east, chance of showers and thunderstorms central and east, highs in the upper 60s northeast to lower 80s southwest. Saturday, partly cloudy, chance of showers and thunderstorms west through the day, then west and central overnight, lows in the 50s, highs in the mid-70s to lower 80s. Sunday, it'll be partly to mostly cloudy, chance of showers and thunderstorms, lows in the mid-50s to lower 60s, highs in the mid-70s northeast to upper 80s southwest. And Monday, partly cloudy, chance of showers and thunderstorms, lows in the upper 50s to mid-60s, highs in the upper 70s to upper 80s. For Prairie Public, I'm Katie David.
You're listening to Main Street on a Thursday. I'm Eric Dethridge. So happy to have you along. It's been fun filling in for Craig this week. He will be back with you on Monday. Coming up, what does the new Superman movie say about our political divides, if anything? Or is it maybe the perfect cocktail for what ails us? Matt Olien has his review. I've got Dakota Date Book as well. But first, Tom Brousseau of the Great American Folk Show. Well, he's been stationed in Medora at the town square every single night, pretty much, this summer. If you ever get out there, make sure you catch him. He always puts on a show, originals, covers from the Great American Songbook, and of course he hosts the radio program Saturdays at 5 p.m. Central, 4 Mountain on Prairie Public, the Great American Folk Show. But while in Medora, he caught up with a couple of members of North Dakota Shakespeare Festival, who recently put on performances in Grand Forks and Medora of the Bards As You Like It. Check it out.
All the world's a stage, and all the men and women merely players. They have their exits and their entrances, and one man in his time plays many parts.
We're here in Medora, North Dakota, at the Harold Schaefer Heritage Center, and I've finally gotten a chance to meet up with the North Dakota Shakespeare Festival. They're in town, and they have been in town for several days, 2 weeks, maybe longer, doing a rendition of As You Like It. And here we are with Stephanie and Veronica from the troupe.
Thank you for having us.
Yes, thank you.
I love that you're bringing Shakespeare outside of the theater. And I imagine that you performed all over the state and outside of the state even. You must really enjoy coming into a new community and performing Shakespeare.
We do, and we think there's something really magical about doing it in the open air. I think some people have preconceived notions about what going to a theater is like, and I think there's something about a public park that is a little more friendly, maybe in some cases a little less stressful, and invites people in a different way.
Yeah, it also provides a really unique opportunity for the actors to take the same show, but to rework the spacing and to discover new things in the moment, as each space is a little bit different. It affects the show in a little bit of a different way, so each audience gets a fun, same show, same story, but a unique presentation of it that's specific to the venue that we're presenting in.
What are some of those notions that we have of the theater?
I think sometimes, especially with Shakespeare, there's the idea that, that's kind of hoity-toity. That's for, the people who think they're highbrow. And and oftentimes it does have a higher dollar amount attached to it as well. So we're hoping to destigmatize that. Shakespeare wrote for the common man, and we believe that his work should still be accessible by the common man. So part of the way that we do that is by removing the price tag. And all of our performances are free of charge, and that's a part of the mission of the company, to make professional quality theater accessible to anyone that wants to experience it.
Well, what an experience that is. I mean, if you think of it, you're bringing Shakespeare to communities and you're not charging anything. So how do you keep the coffers filled?
We are almost 85% grant funded, and the other 15 to 20% comes from individual donors. So at each venue, we pass the hat, and that makes up a fairly significant portion of our budget. But then we also have people who see the work we're doing and say, hey, I would really like to support that in a larger way and make a larger contribution. And they get, thank you in the program and invited to some of our parties in Grand Forks and things like that. So there's perks for the donors as well.
Yeah, we also, especially in our home based town of Grand Forks, we rely on host families and so other ways of utilizing our community to help house actors. And we had some volunteers who fed actors. And so it's sort of a community wide effort to help support in ways to help bring down the financial aspect too.
How did the North Dakota Shakespeare Festival, how did it form? Where did it form?
Sure. So it originally was founded in 2017. I was a faculty member in the theater department at University of North Dakota, and there was a grant for junior faculty to produce either research or creative activity. So I said, could I have $25,000 to start a Shakespeare festival? And miraculously, they said yes. So the festival started that year directly under the umbrella of the university. And for our first 3 years, we were directly a part of UND. And then in 2020, there was some restructuring and the whole world exploded. And we ended up becoming our own entity, and we're currently fiscally sponsored by the Community Foundation of Grand Forks. So we are our own 501c3, but because we have a smaller scope, we only operate about a month out of the year. We found it's easier to have a fiscal sponsor who handles our bookkeeping and all of the less fun things that are involved in running a company. But our university relationship has continued, and this year, for instance, we were back on campus in the Burtness Theater rehearsing, and that's something that UND provided for us in kind. So Veronica mentioned there's a lot of community organizations that help us to keep costs down, so UND Theater has continued to be one of those that still supports us.
We're visiting today with the North Dakota Shakespeare Festival. We have Veronica and Stephanie, Marcus here, and Aaron is here, and maybe a couple of others will join us yet to play some music. What is it about Shakespeare that connects?
I think quite a bit of it comes from the heightened speech and heightened emotion that's required to carry out that speech. That we all have these big feelings and big ideas, but I think in much of American society, we're taught to kind of temper that. But in Shakespeare's plays, we get to see that, and we get to feel the literal connection with the actors who are on stage. That's the beauty of live theater, that you are experiencing empathically with the actors as an audience member.
Yeah, and I think a big part of it too comes down to the relationships in the story, that even if you've never, for example, The Tempest, you've never found yourself in those circumstances, which hopefully most of us haven't, you can still identify with the relationships that are between the characters and see yourself in them, or see your family in them, and recognize the father to daughter or the lover's relationship, and seeing that young love that's being represented in such a heightened way that feels both sentimental and also just like a great representation of things that you can connect with in your own personal existence.
And how about as an actor or actress, how do you connect with the material? And maybe a different question is, Shakespeare comes in a particular format. Mm-hmm. How do you even remember all of the lines? How do you do that?
Yeah. I think most actors who have, you know, had any hand in Shakespeare's work will say it's actually easier than a lot of contemporary language because the rhythm and the meter sort of forces you to get it right. Mm-hmm. And once you become comfortable with that, you know if there's a beat missing, you know if the rhythm is off, and then you're like, oh shoot, I need to go back and check my script.
Well, and it forces you to do your homework. In a contemporary production, you might say, oh, I know what I'm saying. I know what my character is thinking about. But when you have this language, you really are forced to make sure you know what you are saying, or it won't be clear to the audience, or it will become clear to you that you don't know what you're saying as you're up there trying to interact and act off of other people, and you're stuck behind the words coming out of your mouth. So I think in some ways it does make it easier because you get those obstacles out of the way for yourself with a more hands-on approach.
You're passionate about Shakespeare, I can tell. Well, I understand, too, that we're going to hear a little music from you guys today, mm-hmm. and this is going to be a lot of fun. Could you set this song up for us?
Sure. So in As You Like It, much of the play takes place in the Forest of Arden, and there is a forest band of sorts, mm-hmm. a merry band that entertains we call him the good Duke, but the kind of nice guy Duke, who has been banished to the forest with his loyal followers, and they entertain him at his forest dinner parties.
Yes.
And who are our players?
The musicians in that band are actually myself and Veronica and the fabulous Aaron O'Neill, who also sings and plays fiddle. Mm-hmm.
Great. Well, here we go with that song.
Nothing quite like seeing Shakespeare in an outdoor setting. Hope you got a nice taste of that from Tom Brousseau and members of the North Dakota Shakespeare Festival in their recent performance of As You Like It. I'm Eric Dethridge here on Main Street, filling in for Craig. Up next, Matt Olean takes you to the movies and his take on the brand new Superman. Support for Prairie Public is provided by Josh Beauchet, broker and realtor with Real Broker LLC. With a team of agents serving homebuyers, sellers, and investors throughout North Dakota, the Detroit Lakes area, and northwest Minnesota. Josh can be reached at 701-367-3513. Oh, look at this. I get to sit in for a movie review with our critic Matt Olean. And, of course, like, I get to ask you questions about the brand new Superman movie. What an honor that is. Now, some have been praising it for kind of a much-needed sweetness to the franchise, that it harkens back to kind of an innocence of the comic books, but others saying it's, well, kind of snarky, a little bit overstuffed. But for those who haven't caught up with the franchise, let's start with this. Mm-hmm. Since Christopher Reeve and Margot Kidd are going way back, right. I'm just asking for a friend here, okay? Now, can you trace the Superman movies of recent years and any sort of tones or themes running through them?
So, yes, Christopher Reeve, I believe, made 4 Superman movies. They got progressively worse. He got frustrated by the role. He wanted to expand his acting talents. And of course, you know, sadly, he had the riding accident and has since passed away. Now, Brandon Routh inherited the role in Superman Returns in 2005. Then Henry Cavill, who's long been rumored as the next James Bond, took over with Man of Steel in 2013. That was supposed to really get them going, but it followed up with the disasters of Batman versus Superman, which was not aided by the poor casting of Ben Affleck as Batman, and then Justice League. Since then, James Gunn, who directed the Guardians of the Galaxy movies for Marvel, has taken over as CEO of DC Studios. So now, here we go. Gunn is trying to do for DC what he did for Marvel and many other directors did. So that's where we are now, the reboot of James Gunn directing this and casting David Corenswet, who's a Juilliard grad, just like Christopher Reeve was, which is interesting, I think. And, he's impossibly good-looking, as all Superman actors seem to be.
It's a requisite, right?
They just put the glasses on at Clark Kent, and maybe they're not as attractive. So that's where we are. This is already a bigger hit, critically and commercially, than the Henry Cavill films were. So $120 million domestic over the weekend. That's a huge opening. I wasn't quite sure how this was going to open, but I agree with you, Eric, that this is kind of a return to the Christopher Reeve Superman. Innocent, sweet, empathetic, tough, doing the right thing. It's kind of a truth, justice, American way, apple pie type movie. And that's really, I think, what is making this a hit is people want this right now. And Corenswet is well cast as Superman. Rachel Brosnahan, really good as Lois Lane. Nicholas Holt is a very evil Lex Luthor. And we have the Justice Gang, which is really the sidekicks in this that really kind of makes Nathan Fillion as Green Lantern with a ridiculous haircut. Kind of makes that. We have Isabel Merced as Hawkgirl and Eddie Gathegi as Mr. Terrific. They're really good as kind of the sidekicks to him that help him. So all that works well. I liked it better than I thought it would. I thought I would like it. It's not too long. It's just over 2 hours long. It's setting up future things with DC, and it feels like a Marvel movie. So Gunn, this whole getting the gang together thing feels like an Avengers movie. The Justice Gang, they haven't settled on a name for their group yet, so Green Lantern calls them the Justice Gang, which is kind of humorous in the movie. So it feels like a Marvel movie. It's not a great movie, but I did like it better than I thought it would, and I think audiences are enjoying this, plus Crypto the dog, you know, is in it too.
Steals the show,
He steals
apparently.
The show, and dog adoptions are up in the last week. They say wow. Because of the CGI dog Crypto, who's very ill-behaved in this movie, but is important to have as a sidekick as the film wears on.
Yeah. So James Gunn, obviously, he gives himself the keys to the franchise.
He does.
You know, and you talked about sort of the appetite for a movie like this, truth, justice, and the American way, something sweet, something, you know, that we maybe need in these times. And I think that was sort of the same as one of the Spider-Man movies after 9/11. It kind of served that same purpose. Do you see it that way?
Yes, the timing is perfect on this film. I think people want this. We're not making any political statements here. I'm just saying I do think that it is hit at the right time this summer. Maybe the biggest hit of the summer, it looks like. We don't know about Fantastic Four. That's the one I'm not sure of, is Fantastic Four, which premieres next week. Overall, I did like it. The CGI isn't over the top, I didn't think. Lex Luthor wants to kill Superman. There's your plot right there. He's sick of Superman. And I think what makes this film interesting, too, is Superman has flaws. He is defeated early on by this gigantic metahuman in a fictional country in Europe, and he's got to figure out how to do this, how to fight back. Kryptonite gets introduced in the plot as well. So he has frailties. One of the best scenes in the movie is when Lois Lane interviews him as Superman, and of course, Lois Lane in this film knows he's Superman. She knows she's dating Clark Kent / Superman. That's a really interesting interview scene because she interviews him as a journalist, and she's tough with the questions. And of course, they're dating. So, interesting scene.
Let's take a listen to that clip right now.
Are you being serious right now?
Yeah.
You'd let me interview you as Superman?
Sure.
Ready?
Let's do it, Cronkite.
Superman.
Miss Lane.
Recently, you've come under a lot of fire for what some might...
It's a lot of fire.
It's a lot. Today, the Secretary of Defense said he was going to look into your actions. That's funny.
My actions? I stopped a war.
Maybe.
Not maybe. I did.
In effect, you illegally entered a country.
This is how you're going to be?
I'm not the one being interviewed, Superman. Did you consult with the president?
No.
You seemingly acting as a representative of
I
the United States.
I wasn't representing anybody except for me.
Around the
and,
world.
And doing good.
I would question myself in the same situation and consider the consequences.
People were going to die!
All right, points for the Walter Cronkite reference for journalism fans of a certain age. But Matt, man, you could just feel that tension between Lois and Clark slash Superman and a new kind of Superman, I would say, a real emotional vulnerability for 2025.
I think that is what really makes it. Corin Sweat is really good in this role. He's going to play the role again without question because of the success here. I like that Lois knows he's Superman in this movie. Most of the Superman movies, she has no clue. She just thinks it's Clark Kent. So I like that they kind of break the wall there, and she knows he's Superman, and she's sort of got to interview him, and she jokes with him, you just interview yourself. You know, Clark Kent interviews Superman. Those aren't really interviews. That's not journalism, you know. I enjoyed this way more than I thought I was going to enjoy it, and we'll see if DC can capture the magic of Marvel. As a kind of a semi-comic guy when I was young, I always liked Marvel better. Mm-hmm. I just think they have more interesting characters, but we'll see where this goes.
So I hate to be a Debbie Downer, but, you know, it's like I said, it's the times we live in. It's a balm for these times in a way, but because it's this time, you know, everybody's trying to glean, like, oh, are they talking about the war between Israel and Gaza, you know, and each side sort of gets in their own echo chambers. So what's going on with that sort of sub-reaction to the movie?
I think with a lot of movies, people overreact to what the movie is about. This is a popcorn movie about a superhero. If James Gunn has any political axe to grind here, I don't know that he's revealed that. Clearly, Superman is from another planet, so he's technically an immigrant. I am hearing some reaction from some quarters negatively that this film is woke. There's any political message here? I didn't see it, but I do think that Superman being flawed and also doing the right thing, empathetic, is working for the film. I really do.
We're all, no matter what our views, we're all looking for somebody to do the right thing.
He's the guy. He's the original superhero, and I think this does harken back to the originals. And I also am interested in, you know, you kind of compare him to Christopher Reeve. I do think he kind of channels some Christopher Reeve here. I did sense that as well. I still kind of see Gene Hackman as Lex Luthor. The bad Lex Luthor was Jesse Eisenberg.
Oh, yeah.
He's the one in the middle that I didn't care for much. Bradley Cooper has a cameo as Jor-El. You know, we get these scenes where he sees, or he's able to see and hear, and that's an interesting side plot that we're not going to reveal, of what the message is from the parents to Kal-El. That becomes a real key plot point here, and the interpretation or misinterpretation of the message. But Bradley Cooper, you know, has the cameo as Jor-El. Doesn't look like Marlon Brando in the original or anything like that, but it's interesting that they cast a big actor in that role, just as in the first Superman, which really worked because they cast unknown Christopher Reeve and surrounded him with Brando, Hackman, these major stars, and that's what worked with the first film.
And a star was born.
A star was born, yep.
Right.
Superman never made any money saving the world from Solomon Grundy. Sometimes I despair the world will never see another man like him.
All right, Matt, time for your Oscar trivia question. I'm going to make this as easy for you as possible. Going back to the original 1978 Superman starring the aforementioned Margot Kidder and, of course, Christopher Reeve as the man in tights, it was up for 4 Academy Awards. Can you name the categories?
I will say special effects or visual effects, whatever they called it.
Check.
At that time. I'll say music by John Williams.
Original score.
Original
yep.
score, which sounds very much like the Star Wars score. None of the actors were nominated, I know that. Let's go with cinematography.
Nope.
Nope. Okay. Art direction. Production design.
Nope.
Sound.
Yes. Ding.
Editing.
Yes.
Okay.
That's a wrap. Matt got him. Of course. Madeline, thrill sitting in with you on this movie review. We'll catch you next week. What are you going to review next week, by the way?
We're going to talk about AJ Goes to the Dog Park, a film completely financed and shot in Fargo-Moorhead that has a small distribution deal. It just played at the Fargo Theater, and I saw it earlier this year at the Fargo Film Festival. So we're going to kind of, I won't really completely review it because I know too many people in the movie. It's a conflict of interest. But I'll talk about how they got this distribution deal and where people can see it.
Fargo goes nationwide, and nobody's making fun of our accents this time.
No.
Awesome. We've been to the movies with Matt Olean on Main Street. Thanks, Matt.
Yep.
This is Dakota Datebook for July 17th. On this date, in 1946, alumni of the University of North Dakota's secret society called Iron Mask held a reunion. The entry in Iron Mask's internal records reads, "First post-war reunion of the Iron Mask was held on this date in hope that it will mark the first of a long succession of similar reunions." The four signatories were Glenn G. Geiger, John C. West, Edward K. Lander, and John L. Hultang. Glenn G. Geiger went on to found the Glenn G. Geiger Company, a family business that manages executive compensation. John C. West was the president of the University of North Dakota, inducted into Iron Mask on June 6, 1935. He provided mentorship to the organization. Edward K. Lander would serve on the Grand Forks School Board and as a delegate to North Dakota's Constitutional Convention of 1971 and 1972. John L. Hultang went on to become a celebrated professor of journalism at the University of Oregon, who wrote a classic textbook on journalistic ethics. But Iron Mask was controversial. The 1937 Dakota Yearbook said its members would band together for secret activities to coordinate the student body and the administration to the advantage of both. Yet, in 1968, members of Iron Mask wrote, "At no time has the organization served as an arm of the administration. It is not a Gestapo or spy agency for the university or any other groups or organization." This Iron Mask reunion would not be the last. At another reunion dated October 14, 1961, legendary alumnus Chester Fritz was initiated into Iron Mask. Although Iron Mask normally inducted upperclassmen, not alumni, Chester Fritz was an exception. He was an illustrious philanthropist whose name is on UND's main library and a major auditorium. On February 23, 1968, the Dakota Student reported, "Donald Pierce, Chester Fritz's head librarian, found this wooden Iron Mask earlier this week. On its back reads the inscription, Chester Fritz, 1961. The mask was discovered in a collection of Far Eastern masks. The whereabouts of the mask are presently unknown. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Andrew Alexis Varvel. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding by Humanities North Dakota.
Well, that is it for this Thursday edition of Main Street. I'm Eric Dethridge. It's been fun filling in for Craig Blumenschein this week. He'll be back with you on Monday. In the meantime, have a splendid rest of your Thursday.